Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Economics Report and American Mosaic, coming up after As It Is.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. Welcome back. I'm Katie Weaver. On the program today, we explore the situation of almost 1 million Syrian refugees currently living in Lebanon. More and more flee across the border every day. The United Nations is concerned about the limited food aid it can provide the refugees. And it says most refugee children are receiving little or no education. The Syrian refugee crisis in Lebanon, today on As It Is. United Nations agencies have been forced to reduce food aid to about 1 out of 5 Syrian refugees in Lebanon. Those who get no food say they are falling into deep debt. VOA reporter Jamie Detmer investigated the situation from Beirut. Christopher Cruz has his report.
Syrian refugees continue to flee the violence in their country. Many of them are going to Lebanon. UN aid agencies found it increasingly difficult to provide food assistance to them for most of last year. 20% of registered refugees had their food aid ended at the end of 2013. Odai fled the Syrian city of Homs with her husband and 5 children. They are living in a shelter in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli. She says her family stopped receiving assistance, and now they owe a lot of money. Her husband is too sick to look for work. 4 of her children are very young. Her oldest son has a wife and a newborn. She says one of her sons works as a laborer on jobs that sometimes last for just one day. When he finds a job, he can bring money to the family. But Odai says the family owes money to many shops in the area. They do not know how they will pay their debt. She says they owe $2,000 after living in Lebanon for 1.5 years. About 11,000 Syrian refugees arrive in Lebanon every week. Negotiators have made little progress in reaching an agreement to end the civil war in Syria. The flow of Syrian refugees to Lebanon shows no sign of slowing. 1 million Syrians will have registered as refugees in Lebanon by the beginning of March if new arrivals continue at the current rate. Nanette Kelly is the head of the UN Refugee Agency in Lebanon. She says the UN does not have enough food for all of the refugees, so it helps those most at risk.
Most of last year, food was provided, blanket food assistance was provided to everybody who was registered. But this is not something that is a normal practice, but once you have more information, you can further target your provision of food assistance according to vulnerability.
Last year, UN agencies worked to establish who were the most at risk among all registered Syrian refugees. The agencies found 80% of the refugees would have no other form of food support without international assistance. The agencies used this information to make some difficult decisions.
Which meant that there were 20% who had been receiving food who were notified that they would no longer receive it on a regular basis.
But Odai says she does not understand why she and her family are among about 250,000 refugees without food assistance. She says the decision does not seem reasonable. She says she and her husband know other refugees in the camp who are in the same situation as they are. But, she says, those refugees are still receiving UN money to buy food, and her family is not. Even those who receive UN food aid say life is getting harder and more costly. They say they, too, are creating debt. I'm Christopher Cruz. United Nations officials say one-third of the Syrian refugees fleeing to Lebanon are school-aged children, but the majority of them are not able to go to school. We return to Katie Weaver, who has more on the situation of these young refugees.
11-year-old Mara has been in Lebanon for 18 months. She lives in an unofficial refugee settlement near the coastal Lebanese city of Tripoli. Her family had lived on a farm near the Syrian city of Homs. They fled when a rocket hit their farmhouse during an attack. Mara is luckier than most of the refugee children in Lebanon. She is attending school. Mara says it is difficult for her to learn in Lebanon's French-based educational system. In Syria, she was taught in Arabic. She says she speaks Lebanese to understand the other students. But there are problems. She says they sometimes insult her and other Syrian students for being refugees. But Mara at least has a chance of reaching her goal to become a nurse. In her settlement, there are about 200 families. Only a few of them have children in school. Media reports about the refugees are mostly about their emergency needs, like food and medical care. Those needs take most of the humanitarian aid as well. But the longer-term needs of the refugees are becoming more central as the Syrian civil war continues. The lack of educational possibilities for refugee children is a major concern for Nanette Kelly.
The situation of children is rather dire. There are over 300,000 now Syrian school-aged children, which is the same number of Lebanese children who were registered in Lebanese schools last year. And while the Ministry of Education has indicated they could absorb 100,000 in the formal education system, that still leaves over 200,000 kids without a formal education option.
The UN and non-governmental groups are working together to try to provide basic reading and writing classes for children. They are centering efforts on the temporary refugee settlements that are being created. The Lebanese government has refused permission for the building of official refugee camps. But Ms. Kelly says basic reading and writing classes are not going to meet the needs of older children in the camps. And that's As It Is for today. I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for joining us.
The Economics Report is next, followed by American Mosaic. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The United Nations World Food Program has appealed for help in fighting the food crisis in Zimbabwe. The World Food Program says more than 2 million people there are facing hunger or starvation. The United States recently answered the appeal. The U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe, Bruce Wharton, announced a $4 million grant to the UN agency. The donation brings the total U.S. assistance to fighting hunger in Zimbabwe to $29 million this year. Ambassador Wharton announced the donation earlier this month while on a visit to Matabeleland, North Province. The World Food Program says Matabeleland North is one of four provinces where the food crisis is severe. However, some Zimbabweans protested the U.S. announcement. Robert Schuma was among the demonstrators during the ambassador's visit. He says the protest was against the financial and travel restrictions Western countries have ordered against President Robert Mugabe and his allies. The financial and travel sanctions were first declared more than 10 years ago. The U.S. and other countries acted after reports of human rights abuses and unfair elections in Zimbabwe. Mr. Schuma believes the sanctions should be removed. Ambassador Wharton said the demonstration was an example of freedom of expression. He said the United States wants the people of Zimbabwe to reduce their need for seasonal humanitarian assistance. Zimbabwe has grown to depend on such assistance since 2000. When its agricultural production began to decrease. Officials have blamed the decreased production on a lack of rainfall. Some critics of President Mugabe blamed his land reforms. They say those policies reduce the productivity of the country's farms. Since 2000, the main crop, corn, has been in short supply. It is now the hunger season, the last 3 months before farmers harvest their crops. During this period, the World Food Program says, it needs to raise $86 million to feed more than 2 million hungry Zimbabweans. The WFP says the latest U.S. donation is still not enough to pay for its health and nutrition activities in Zimbabwe. The UN agency says it needs $60 million in the next 6 months to finance these programs. And that's the Economics Report from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to American Mosaic from VOA Learning English. I'm June Sims. Today, we tell about a museum in Virginia that helps tell the story of slavery in America. We also hear some great jazz from the past brought to new life in a Broadway musical. But first, we look at a movie about an explosive historical event. Pompeii was a Roman city that existed hundreds of years ago. A violent eruption of Mount Vesuvius in the year 79 AD buried the city and killed many people. Now, a movie using the latest 3D technology tells the story of the explosive event. Catherine Cole reports.
It was the jewel of our empire.
People of Pompeii! Let the games begin!
Researchers who study ancient cultures say parts of the movie Pompeii are very true to history. Sarah Yeomans is an archaeologist and professor at West Virginia University. She praises the film for its recreation of the city of Pompeii.
I think they did a wonderful job recreating the city from the archaeological site.
Images of people of Pompeii buried in rock and ash awaken the imagination. Pompeii director Paul Anderson visited the ancient city of Pompeii. He remembers a representation of a couple holding each other when the ash and other material came down.
There are these two intertwined bodies, and the lovers are kind of just looking at one another. And that, for me, was very emotional, and that was really the basis of the entire movie.
The film Pompeii is mostly a love story, but it shows many interesting details about the event. Director Paul Anderson says Pompeii is the perfect movie for 3D. The 3D technology captures the powerful explosions of Mount Vesuvius.
Well, I think this is the kind of movie that 3D was really invented for. You want to be immersed in this kind of ancient civilization and the sheer spectacle of it.
The movie shows Vesuvius expelling balls of fire over Pompeii that destroy everything in their path. But experts say the eruption was not exactly like that. Rosalie Lopez is a scientist with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology. She says the eruption would have caused volcanic rock and ash to rain down on the city. She adds that the movie makers were correct to include an earthquake and tsunami in the event. But she says the real tsunami hundreds of years ago was much smaller. Ms. Lopez adds that people who live near Mount Vesuvius today would get a warning before an eruption.
We now have a lot of early warning systems because volcanoes don't erupt without some precursor sign. And Vesuvius could erupt again. Vesuvius does have smaller eruptions, so it doesn't mean that it would be as bad as it was back then.
Archaeologist Sarah Yeomans says Pompeii filmmakers do capture the politics of the time. It is not a favorable representation of the Roman rulers.
The Pompeians did not unilaterally consider themselves to be Romans. They were brought involuntarily into the expanding empire.
The desire for freedom is an idea expressed again and again in the film. Actor Adewale Akinoye Agbaje plays the enslaved fighter Atticus. He says Pompeii's message about freedom and equality are timeless.
Freedom and equality, which is timeless, you know, and I think we all still strive for that today.
Pompeii is surely a Hollywood love story. It does not exactly represent the natural disaster that destroyed the city, But most experts agree that the movie does give people a good idea of what life was like in ancient Pompeii.
And the walls kept tumbling down in the city that we love. Great clouds all over the hills, bringing darkness from above.
The award-winning movie, 12 Years a Slave, is based on the writings of Solomon Northup. Mr. Northup was captured and sold into slavery in 1841. His kidnapper was a well-known slave trader named James Birch. Mr. Birch owned property in Alexandria, Virginia, where he would imprison the men, women, and children before their sale. The large property was called a slave pen. Today, all that remains of the slave pen is one building. It has been turned into a museum about slavery. At the Freedom House Museum, visitors get a close look at what slaves experienced. Julian Kiganda is the supervisor of the museum. She says she cannot imagine how the captured felt about the possibility of never seeing their families again.
Seeing that African Americans had experienced on a regular basis the separation of family, that for me was just so heartbreaking.
Most of the slaves picked tobacco on local farms. They were also sold to cotton farmers farther south. Audrey Davis is the head of Alexandria's Black History Museum. She says slaves came from many different places.
They were coming from a variety of places and then being held in the slave pens until they were shipped out or until someone was buying them directly from the pen, and then they would be brought out for inspection.
James Birch's slave pen was one of the most profitable in the country. There was a kitchen, an eating area, a hospital, and a space for exercise. The traders knew that slaves who looked healthy would sell for higher prices. Miss Kaganda says some traders would even give slaves new clothes.
The tailor shop would create the clothes that the slaves would wear at the market so that they looked expensive. The slaves, they would actually try to get rid of these clothes as soon as they could because they did not want to be reminded of being sold at market.
Miss Kaganda says slaves were sold for as much as four times what the traders had paid for them.
People would pay $1,200 for a slave back in those days, which is the equivalent of almost $30,000 in today's money.
Jacqueline Nordorf visited the museum from California. She says it is scary to imagine slaves crowded against the museum walls.
It saddens me, but it is our history. It was scary to be in a place where the slaves were actually kept and these people were sold for their lives.
The victims were chained together and shipped to markets in North America. Sometimes after sale, they were forced to walk long distances to farms. Visitors to the Freedom House Museum are permitted to touch the slave chains. Miss Kaganda explains why.
We felt it was important for people to have, you know, the ability to actually feel these things and feel the reality of what happened here.
The Northern Virginia chapter of the Urban League owns the building. The Urban League is an organization that works to empower African Americans. Cynthia Dinkins is the chief executive officer of the chapter. Ms. Dinkins says she and other workers feel the presence of the dead in the museum. Ms. Dinkins says they have seen and heard things they cannot explain.
I felt something brush against me, but I didn't feel threatened at all. And they're like, oh no, yes, yes, we've experienced things like that, doors opening and closing, footsteps.
The slave pen was closed during the American Civil War. The city of Alexandria surrendered to U.S. government soldiers in 1861.
The slave pen was turned into a prison used to jail disobedient government soldiers and rebel soldiers who were captured. The Cotton Club in New York City helped bring fame to many African-American performers during the early 1920s to the 1940s. Now, a new musical play celebrates some of the greatest jazz musicians who played there. Bob Doty has more on the show After Midnight.
Two men partnered to create After Midnight. Wynton Marsalis is the artistic director of jazz at Lincoln Center in New York City. His friend, Jack Vertel, is the director of a company that brings old musicals back to life in new shows. Their shared love of the music of this time gave birth to After Midnight.
Midnight, Harlem. Once it was true. In 1932, Harlem's heartbeat was a drumbeat. After midnight, early blue evening, lights ain't come on yet. Coming on now!
The Cotton Club was in the Harlem neighborhood of the city. David Levering Lewis is a history professor at New York University and writer of the book When Harlem Was in Vogue. He says, After Midnight shows what one night at the famous nightclub was really like.
I thought it captured the flavor of what would have been one night the best ever at the Cotton Club.
Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, and Bessie Smith are just some of the musicians represented in After Midnight. Mr. Vertel and Mr. Marsalis used old sound recordings from the Cotton Club to recreate what it was really like.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our famous Cotton Club. It's great to see so many friends here tonight enjoying themselves in spite of the cover charge. And if you can spare a minute from your merrymaking, I'd like to have the pleasure of introducing the greatest living master of jungle music, the rip-roaring harmony hound, none other than Duke Ellington.
But there is an ugly side to the history. The Cotton Club was located in the center of the African-American neighborhood of Harlem. The club used black performers, but the club only permitted white people to attend the shows. Mr. Levering Lewis describes how even the celebrated composer W.C. Handy was not permitted to enter.
As everyone knows, it was infamously racially exclusive. W.C. Handy wished to go one evening to the Cotton Club, and he was turned away, and he could hear his music being performed.
Cotton Club shows often presented African Americans in insulting ways, but this is not explored in After Midnight. Mr. Vertel says the creators wanted to free the music from its past.
Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street.
I'm June Sims. Our program was written by Anna Mateo and Jonathan Evans. Katie Weaver was the producer. Do you have a question about American life, people, or places? Send an email to learningenglish@voanews.com. We might answer your question in a future show. Join us again next week for American Mosaic from VOA Learning English.